May it please the court, my name is Kylie Dunn, registration number 40638, and I'm here on behalf of Ms. Stock. I'd like to focus my argument today on the first issue in the opening brief, which is whether the police officer's entry into Ms. Stock's home was unconstitutional, and therefore the evidence that the officer gathered while inside, including her statements, should have been suppressed. The officer's entry into Ms. Stock's home was unconstitutional, and here's why. When the officer knocked on Ms. Stock's door, he knocked on the door of a hotel room, which is where Ms. Stock was living, so it was her home. Mr. Stock answered. Mr. Stock was Ms. Stock's father. And according to the officer, it was Mr. Stock who let him inside. Mr. Stock did not live in the hotel room with his daughter, and he did not have the necessary authority over the premises to consent to the officer's entry into Ms. Stock's home. Therefore, the officer's reliance on Mr. Stock's consent to enter the home was unconstitutional under Illinois versus Rodriguez, unless the officer had a reasonable belief that Mr. Stock did have that necessary authority. Here, the record is clear that the officer had no such reasonable belief, and therefore his entry and reliance on that consent was unconstitutional. Further, even if this court were to find that the officer had a reason to believe that Mr. Stock could enter, that he could enter into the hotel room based on Mr. Stock's consent, what Mr. Stock actually did was too ambiguous to constitute and clear and ambiguous, was too ambiguous to constitute clear consent to the officer's entry. And finally, although not argued by the state on appeal, below, the trial court relied in part on its finding that Ms. Stock herself consented to the officer's presence when she agreed to talk to the officer and cleared a chair for him. However, to the extent that these actions constitute consent to the officer's entry, her consent was tainted by the officer's prior illegal entry into the room and cannot justify his presence.
Ms. Dunn, is it correct that the trial court relied on actual authority as opposed to apparent authority, or did it rely on both as to justify the entry?
I believe that the trial court's order relied basically explicitly on People v. White. And in People v. White, a division of this court relied on apparent authority and also a version of what it called actual authority. And in People v. White, like the court did here, it sort of found that the person who answered the door had authority to consent to the entry based on their relationship with the premises.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the White case, because I know it relied on two out-of-state cases. One was Nix out of Alaska, which was an apparent authority case.
Yes.
And then Schaffer, that I believe was an actual authority case. And so it was a little bit, it seemed like it was relying on both theories, saying under either theory that the entry was justified. So did the trial court here rely on both theories, or?
Yes, I think the trial court here relied on both theories, although I don't think the order is explicit. And she mostly, the trial court judge is referencing things like that Mr. Stock was the father, that Mr. Stock, that they were waiting for the police and factors like that, and finding that he had the authority to consent to the officer's entry. And I think it's important to note that People versus Schaffer was published several years before the U.S. Supreme Court came out with Illinois versus Rodriguez. And I think Illinois versus Rodriguez clearly supplies the rule that this court should follow in this case.
Was it relevant that they were in fact actually just waiting for the police to come to the hotel room and expected them to be coming?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that that's a relevant fact here. I think that the rule is that an officer has to ask to come into someone's home. Here, when he got to the door, he knocked on the door. someone answered the door. That was Mr. Stock. And at the time that Mr. Stock answered the door, the officer had no belief that Mr. Stock had authority to consent to his entry. So it was unreasonable for him to rely on that consent. And I think also importantly, you know, the test is created for the police officer, what the police officer is supposed to do when confronted with certain realities. It's not about what the people inside were thinking.
What should the officer have done here that he didn't?
I think the officer, knowing that Ms. Stock lived there and knowing from the hotel manager that Ms. Stock was there at that time, he should have asked to speak to Ms. Stock.
Okay.
Was there testimony at the motions hearing that everyone was expecting the officer to come to the room?
There is some testimony to that effect. Apparently what had happened was Ms. Stock had confessed to the co-owner of the hotel. And at that time they had called the police. And the police arrived that evening right after that call. So there's some indication that she knew he was coming, yes.
All right. And then the officer also testified at the hearing as to his knowledge of the father's relationship to the either to the defendant or to the room.
Right. According to the testimony at the motions hearing, it's not as good as perhaps it could have been, but he testified that he knew Ms. Stock lived there. He testified that he was never told by this co-owner, which is who gave him all his background info, that he was never told by that person that her father also lived there. The exact exchange that I'm relying on is defense counsel said, and to the best of your knowledge, he, meaning Mr. Stock, was just visiting his daughter who lives in the hotel room. And the officer answered, correct, that was my assumption.
Okay.
And if this court finds that the entry was illegal, all the evidence that was gathered inside has to be suppressed under the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, both her statements, including the entire interview that the officer conducted, and the key. She had a key to the vending machines that she turned over to him at that time.
All right, let me ask you about the White case a little bit, because my understanding is the evidence in our case is that father was visiting daughter.
Right.
And in the White case, there was a guest who was who had actual authority to give the limited entry into the entry area of a home. So how would this case be distinguishable?
Well, it's distinguishable based on the facts that were available to the officer at the time. First of all, under White, I think it's important that that all took place at like 1:30 at night, and it was an overnight guest who answered the door. And the case is clear that the officer had no reason to believe that that person did not live there. Here, in contrast, we have someone arriving and it was apparently in White also, it was a home. We don't have a lot of details on it. But here, in contrast, we're talking about a hotel room that was a home, which I think just common sense implies is less likely to have multiple people living there. We have the fact that he arrived at the hotel at 6:20 at night, which is a time when you wouldn't necessarily expect everyone who answers the door to be a resident. And finally, we have the officer's own statement that he did not believe that this person who answered the door lived there. And I think the law is clear that someone who lets the officer in has to have the common authority over the premises, and that's the state's burden to establish, which was not done here. Or the officer has to have a reasonable belief, although mistaken, but still reasonable, that that person had that common authority. And there's no showing here on this record that that person, that the officer had such a reasonable belief.
All right, let me ask you then, does it make a difference that this was the father of the defendant? Because I know there's some language about if someone is more than a casual visitor. So is the father more than a casual visitor?
I don't think it matters under Illinois versus Rodriguez that his relationship to the premises. In Rodriguez, it was the girlfriend or ex-girlfriend who had actually lived there until recently, who still spent the night there sometimes, And she still was found not to have that common authority. Here, you know, it's her father, but there's nothing in the record that helps establish for the state that he had some kind of common authority over the premises. There's nothing about their relationship or their circumstances that would support that.
Ms. Dunn, I have a question. The state argues that in the alternative, the erroneous denial of a motion to suppress was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Could you talk about that?
Yes. First of all, this is clearly constitutional error. So in evaluating whether or not this error was harmless, this court would have to be sure beyond a reasonable doubt that the verdict was surely unattributable to the introduction of this evidence at trial. I don't think that this court can reach that conclusion here. First of all, her statements to the officer are essentially the only evidence at trial of the felony amount to support that it was over $1,000. Secondly, as discussed in the second issue in the opening brief, as a result of these statements coming in later in trial, the state was allowed to cross-examine the officer about whether or not during his interview of her, he believed her statements that she intended to return the money to the hotel. That was extremely damaging evidence, as one of the key issues at trial was whether or not she intended to return the money. And also importantly, I know that the state relied in part on the fact that she had previously confessed to Mr. Treese, the hotel co-owner. However, the detail apparently provided in those statements is far less than the detail that was provided in the statement that was given to this officer, including how she got it at night, how she took the key, waited until nighttime to go to the vending machines, detail like that, and it's not clear that that was part of her statements to Mr. Treese. So I think given those facts, the introduction of this evidence at trial was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Let me just ask you one thing. If we were to agree with you and conclude that the motion to suppress should have been granted.
Yes.
I think the relief you asked for is a remand for a new trial.
Yes.
Would that obviate the necessity of addressing any of the other issues raised in the briefs?
First of all, I think this court would still have to address the issue that goes to the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the theft count. I would also, I would be afraid, so I guess her statement wouldn't come in, so the second issue would not be a problem. I can't think beyond the one sufficiency issue that I know this court would still have to address. I'm thinking maybe also the one that has to do with the jurors, but I'm having trouble rationalizing that right now.
Okay, thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
We have a minute and 46 left.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Carmen Morales on behalf of the people. My attorney registration is 34852. And I will address the illegal entry issue, and I stand on my brief as to the other issues. But if this court has any questions, I will be happy to answer any of them. And the first thing that I would like to address is that Illinois v. Rodriguez deals with common authority. And the people are not arguing that the father in this case had common authority. We are arguing that under People v. White, the father had either actual or apparent authority to allow the officer to entry the defendant's room. So I don't think that holding in Rodriguez is dispositive. It is not controlling in this case, and it is not what People v. White, it is not inconsistent with the holding in Rodriguez.
Well, Ms. Moralita, we've used the terms actual authority, apparent authority, and now you're referring to common authority. Mm-hmm. Is there a distinction between common authority and the other two?
I believe there is. Common authority refers when more than one person have some kind of use of and control over the property, like they both reside in the same apartment or home. They somehow have some common use of the resident, which is not the case in here. We know that the evidence support that the father did not live with the defendant in the hotel. So again, that is not the issue in this case. We are not arguing common authority. Under People v. White, the division concluded that even though the family friend did not have common authority, either under doctrine of the actual or apparent authority, it was allowed, the friend had authority to allow police into, in this case, it was in the living room of the home. And in here, under People v. White, as I say, the father had actual or apparent authority to allow entry into the defendant's room. It was only like two steps into the room because he was not a casual visitor. He was defendant's father with whom she had a close relationship. She even testified that they had a joint account and she would get together with her father to go over her finances. And the second, the consent was limited to an area where a visitor would normally be received. And in this case, it was just two steps into the entry room of the small hotel room. In White, the division said that even allowing the friend into the living room was okay. And the court, I believe, in there concluded that would be a place where a guest would be received with more reason here, which was only two steps into the room. In addition, the record supports that the father opened the door on behalf of the defendant. This was a very small room, and the defendant, I think the strong inference is that allowed him to do so because they were together in the room, and there is no evidence that the trial court found that defendant prohibited the father from opening the door or somehow unauthorized the father after the father had done so. Both defendant and the father knew why the officer was there, and also the strong inference is that they both were waiting for him. Defendant had confessed to the owner, and defendant had already talked with one officer in the morning and had, I guess, denied that she had taken the money. So essentially, they were waiting for police. And
let me ask you this question, because yes. They were both in the room. Did the police officer have any obligation, knowing that it was Ms. Stock's room, to ask her for consent?
Okay, so the father, the officer knocked on the door, and this is what the record supports. The father opened the door, and the officer asked whether he could talk with defendant. And the father stepped back and allowed the officer to enter the room. Then they had a small discussion, and the father asked the officer whether he wanted him to stay or to leave. And the officers said, please give us some privacy, and the father left. And then the officer stepped a few more steps into the room and introduced himself and asked the defendant whether he could come in and talk with her about what had happened. Defendant said yes and clear off a chair and for the officer to sit. And defendant doesn't dispute that she consented to the officer entry. What she argues is that this happened after the entry was, he was already illegally in the office, in the room.
All right. Well, let me rephrase my question then. Before the officer crossed the threshold into the room, did the officer have any obligation to, at that point, ask the defendant for consent to enter?
Well, I mean, the father opened the door.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he introduced himself. He said, can I talk with the defendant? So I don't know how what else could he have done if somebody else opened the door. Can I talk with the defendant? The father opened the door, stepped back and allowed the officer, and then the father asked if he wanted him to stay. I don't know. I guess I don't understand, because he opened, somebody else other than the defendant opened the door. He just asked that person, whom I think he believed it was the father who was visiting his daughter.
Well, I suppose he could not have entered.
Well, he asked for permission to enter to the father. He said, I believe that the record supports that. He said, can I talk with defendant? And the father stepped back.
He knew that the father did not live in the hotel room, did he not?
Yes, he did. He knew, I guess, the testimony was that he assumed he was just visiting the daughter.
Okay, so my understanding from you then is that the officer did not have an obligation to ask the defendant because father was there and invited him in. Okay, and he knew the father did not live there.
Yes.
And so I know your argument, though, is that the father had actual authority. So what are the factors to show that father had actual authority to invite the officer in?
I'm saying actual and apparent authority under People v. White.
Okay.
Because that's what the division concluded. Actual, I believe, because they were both together in the same room. I guess the trial court concluded the strong suggestion is that defendant allowed the father to open the door, there's no indication that she prohibited the father from doing so, or said, oh, father, what have you done? So both apparent and actual under People v. White.
Okay, and then understanding that actual authority and apparent authority are mutually exclusive, then what would be the factors to show that there was apparent authority?
Well, apparent authority, because the police, the officer, believed that the father was visiting the daughter. So apparent authority would be he opened the door, and he did it. He allowed him to enter into that limited, like two steps into the room. So I don't think it was reasonable for the officer to believe that the father could do so. It was just a very limited space in the room. It's not that the father said, go ahead. And actual, because I believe, you know, there was a small room. If he opened the door, I think the suggestion is because he did it on behalf of the defendant. Defendant also, I guess, contends that even if the father did or could consent, he didn't, because it wasn't clear and unambiguous. And I think this was, I guess, turned into a credibility determination, whether the court believed the father's version or the officer's version. And I think this court should defer to the trial court finding, because it is supported by the record that the father invited the officer to enter the room, and there is absolutely no evidence that the officer used any threats or force or coercion or created any oppressive environment that could have led the father to believe that he had no choice but to let him in.
Ms. Moralita, could I ask you about the harmless error question, mm-hmm. same question I had from Ms. Dunn? And I guess I'll get very specific for you. She took the position that there was very limited evidence for the felony amount. So could you address that in the harmless error context?
Yes. Any error, I guess, was harmless because she had confessed. It is true that the only evidence as to the felony amount came from her statements. So that's what I, in my brief, I argue that if this court were to conclude that the entry was illegal, I guess her statements could not come in. But still, the conviction would stand. I guess the remedy would be to remand for entry of judgment as a misdemeanor. But there's no, I guess, the only evidence as to the specific amount, over $1,000, came from her statements to the officer that he later testified at trial. I guess if this court has any other questions, the people ask that the defendant's conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to return briefly to Judge Kapalki's question, I think that if you find that the trial court should have granted the motion to suppress, I also think that this court should consider the issue about the hearsay evidence at trial, whether or not Ms. Stock can testify as to her mental health, and of course the sufficiency issue. I think the hearsay issue and the mental health issue are likely to rise on retrial. I'd also like to just real quick get to what the record was at the motions hearing. First of all, the testimony about the relationship between the defendant and her father and the joint bank account, that did not come out at the motions hearing and therefore can't be relied on by this court. Secondly, the record as to what happened, what Mr. Stock actually did when he answered the door and what the officer actually said, according to the findings by the trial court in its order, in its written order, did not make any findings that either party said anything. At the motions hearing, the officer did not ever testify as to statements made by either. The father testified that the officer said to him, "I want to speak to Ms. Stock, and would you please leave?" Finally, I just want to highlight that, to get back to a question by Judge Lichtenstein, this idea in White about a special rule for a guest, I think it's very important that in White they also relied on an apparent authority doctrine to allow that entry. And I think that the facts that support a special visitor relationship will generally support apparent authority. And I ask this court to overturn the trial court's order and remand for retrial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.